Could you all step in, please, so we can get started? Okay, this session is the Society of Labor Economics, Labor Economists Presidential Address. The presidential address will be given by Janet Curry, and it's my great privilege, I'm excited about it, to introduce her, even though she doesn't need an introduction, especially in this crowd. I first met Janet when she was a graduate student at Princeton in the mid-80s, so this is a particularly nice thing for me because I've literally known her entire professional career, and she is currently the Henry Putman Professor of Economics and Public Affairs and Chair of the Economics Department at Princeton University, and she's also held chaired professorships at Columbia and UCLA. She's given outstanding service to this society, the American Economic Association, many other professional organizations and government agencies around the world. But what really distinguishes Janet's career is her long dedication to finding current, important public policy questions that demand rigorous empirical analysis, even when there don't appear to be any data. So you find the data, you get those data from diverse, often non-conventional sources, and combine them in imaginative ways, opening up real, evidence-based debate on the policy question that she's undertaking. In this feature of her career, she's been an incredible model and mentor for an enormous number of co-authors, graduate students, and colleagues. Here's where I go off script. So if you haven't looked at her CV, naturally I had to, I wanted to, there are 6 different awards for graduate student mentoring listed on that CV from 2 different universities. It's really an incredible tribute to her dedication to producing new economists and training them in the traditions that have also marked her work. Back on script. Her early work was on labor market institutions, particularly public sector unions, arbitration, and other hot topics from the 1980s that most of the people in the room are too young to remember. She quickly branched out, though, into the emerging field of health economics and the role of early childhood investments on long-term outcomes and began to make her mark on the profession. She studied early childhood education and health, Head Start, other preschool human capital investments, and continued with the role of poor early childhood health and healthcare options on long-term outcomes. And these characteristics of the research, focusing on very current policy questions and looking for evidence not just about whether the policy worked this week, but whether it worked over a long observation period, that have characterized a lot of her research. Her recent work has focused on the healthcare industry itself, an industry that Americans have been watching transform in ways that were completely unanticipated even a decade ago. Indeed, we all watched it transform again yesterday. I'm pretty sure most of the other people here read the news alert when the Supreme Court decision, the important one from yesterday as opposed to the important one from today, was released. So it's particularly fitting that she's going to address us on her new subject today, diagnosing expertise, human capital, and performance. So without any further introduction, Janet Curry.
So thank you very much, John, for that lovely introduction. And thank you all for coming. I understand there's lots of other things competing for your attention, like the soccer game, the jazz festival. So I will try and be relatively brief. My talk today is based on work with Bentley McLeod and Jessica Van Paris. The motivation for the talk is the observation that we all rely on experts in many fields, doctors, lawyers, mechanics, teachers. Of course, we're experts ourselves, professors. But it's very difficult to judge the quality of experts. Often, we end up judging the quality of the expert by looking at the outcomes and saying that people who get good outcomes must be good experts. We're going to propose to try and judge expert quality with reference to the actions of the experts. And the trouble with doing that is then you need some sort of a metric for judging, was this an appropriate action or not? Existing professional metrics often take the forms of simple checklists, if this, do that. But real life decision making is, of course, much more complex. We're going to break expert performance into two parts. One is deciding on the appropriate course of action, and the second is actually implementing the action. And then we're going to try and use big data in the form of administrative records to try and develop a standard for measuring the quality in both of those dimensions. The specific example has to do with doctors, and doctors fit well into this framework because a really important thing that doctors do is decide what to do to somebody, and then, of course, we'd like them to do a good job of it, whatever it is that they're doing. We're going to show that it's feasible to use patient records to develop a meaningful metric. And then we're going to also show that both of these aspects of doctor quality are really important to outcomes. So in medicine, there are many examples of these simple checklists. This particular one is from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid. It has to do with heart attack care. And you can see there's lots of these kind of 0-1 measures. So somebody who has a heart attack should get aspirin when they arrive. They should get aspirin when they're discharged. Going down a couple of lines, it says fibrinolytic therapy should be received within 30 minutes of hospital arrival. Primary PCI received within 90 minutes of hospital arrival. So in this example, the doctor is good if the heart attack patient gets an aspirin, or more seriously, if this PCI, this is angioplasty or inserting a balloon to clear a blockage, happens within 90 minutes, if that's the particular thing that's chosen, or fibrinolytic therapy is clot-busting drugs, if that's what they do, then they're supposed to do that within 30 minutes. Now, the reason why I'm sort of belaboring this is because the checklist doesn't say anything about whether you should have done one thing or the other, which is clearly one of the most important aspects of care. So this checklist, which appears to be very detailed, doesn't actually give you any guidance on the really important question, which is, what should I do with this patient? The evidence, however, suggests that doctors do respond to this type of protocol. So, for example, there's a paper by Amon Doyle, Kowalski, and Williams that looks at a protocol which says that you should treat very low birth weight babies, that is, babies less than 1,500 grams, with more care than heavier babies. And they show, in fact, that babies just less than 1,500 grams are more likely to survive than babies just over 1,500 grams. What that means is that, first, the care that they're giving to the very low birth weight babies is effective, but second, that there are some inefficiencies in allocation of care because these babies who are just over 1,500 grams presumably could have benefited from the same type of care, but they don't get it. Similarly, Diane Alexander and I have a paper looking at a different protocol which has to do with treating childhood asthma. And the protocol says, well, you should treat infants with more care than slightly older children with asthma. What we find is that doctors do respond to that. They're much more likely to admit babies than slightly older children. But again, our results suggest some inefficiency because in this case, even though the infants are more likely to be admitted, they don't seem to have any superior health outcome. So these protocols, as I say, are followed, but they're very simple and they miss a lot of the nuances of patient conditions. So in the very low birth weight baby example, if an infant was very low birth weight but otherwise healthy, maybe they would be a less good candidate for invasive procedures than a heavier infant that had a severe respiratory problem. So you'd like a protocol that was a little bit more complicated and considered multiple aspects of the patient condition. We're going to try and consider the matching of patients to procedures. And in order to do that, it's very helpful if we can boil down the different aspects of patient condition into a single index of appropriateness for a particular procedure. If you can do that, then the doctor's problem is to determine a cutoff above which patients get the procedure and below which they do not. So think about it in terms of a diagram. Along the x-axis here, we have some kind of index of patient condition. It goes from 0 to 1. A 0 is patients who definitely shouldn't get some procedure. A 1 is patients who definitely should get the procedure. And in a world of perfect certainty, you would have a line like the blue line where doctors would pick a cutoff value. Patients below that cutoff don't get the procedure. Patients above the cutoff get the procedure. In the real world, we don't have perfect certainty. We have a lot of uncertainty about patient condition, but it should still be the case that on average, patients who are less good candidates are less likely to get procedures, and patients who are better candidates should get procedures. So in the real world, we're going to have a line that looks more like the red line in this diagram. So starting from the red line, we can think about, well, what would it mean to have an improvement in diagnostic or decision-making ability? Well, it would mean that we resolved some of the uncertainty and we went from something like the red line to something that looked more like the blue line, say the green line. I guess I should apologize for people who are red-green colorblind in this slide. But what that would mean is that you reduced the probability that the low appropriateness people would get procedures, and you increased the probability that the high appropriateness people would get procedures. We're going to use administrative data to develop an index like this that can be used to rank patients. And then we're going to estimate doctor-specific regressions to see how each doctor responds to that index. And we're going to say that doctors who are more responsive are better diagnosticians. So just to illustrate different possible types, again, along the x-axis here, we have patients ranked in terms of their appropriateness for a procedure. We could think about there being doctors who never did the procedure, pretty much, and that would be the brown line at the bottom. Or we could think about doctors who did this procedure to everybody. So this would be like obstetricians in Brazil who give C-sections to 85% of their patients. Or what we're arguing is a better doctor would be one who didn't do the procedure for the low-risk people and did do the procedure for the high-risk people. That would look more like the dashed line. And in our model, that would you can see there's a higher slope. So we're going to show that even in cases in which a lot of procedure use is thought to be unnecessary, if you just reduce the procedure use across the board, that would harm high-risk patients. So it's not going to be a Pareto optimal approach. That may seem obvious, but many policy recommendations, such as changing reimbursement schedules for invasive procedures, would have that effect. In contrast, if you could do something to improve diagnostic skill, that is the matching of the patient to the procedure, you could improve outcomes for both the high and the low risk, even if you didn't change the incidence of procedure use. We're also going to think about how increases in doctor skill performing procedure affects the choice of procedure. This has a quite different impact and basically just increases procedure use across the board. The intuition being that if I'm better at doing, say, a surgical procedure, then I'm more likely to do surgery, even on the low-risk people, because I'm going to harm them less than if I was less good at doing the surgery. So just to give an overview of the rest of this talk, I'm going to very briefly develop a model that highlights the doctor's ability to process information about a patient's condition and make a decision. Then we're going to apply the model to two different examples, one of which is C-section, the other is heart attack. And we're going to demonstrate that doctors who have better decision-making skills have measurably better patient outcomes. And then at the very end, I'll think about a little bit about how that might affect how we think about evaluating other types of experts. Okay, so this is kind of an overview of empirically what we do. We estimate a propensity for a patient to get an invasive procedure, which I'll call C. Then we use the estimates to come up with the index, which is the H capital I. So the index is related to the true patient condition, but has some error, which is a measurement error in our index of patient condition. And then for each doctor, we estimate a model in which there's a slope term that says how much does the doctor respond to the patient condition, and then there's a doctor-specific fixed effect. The point of the model, then, is to say, what do these parameters mean, the theta and the alpha? We're going to assume that physicians have well-defined preferences and that they're going to choose the procedure that maximizes their own expected benefit. Now, saying that they're maximizing their own benefit doesn't mean that they don't care about patients. It just means that patients are only one of the things that they care about. So the utility function for the doctor has the term H, which is a measure of the benefit of the procedure if the procedure is done at the sort of normal level of skill. Physicians also know their own skill level, which is S, and that affects the utility of doing different procedures. They know how much they're going to be paid, which is the M term. And then we also add a term to allow patients to have different preferences for procedures. That's the alpha. The physician then collects the information about the patient condition and chooses the invasive procedure if and only if the utility of doing the invasive procedure is greater than the utility of doing the non-invasive procedure. So equation two here just rewrites the differences as an equation. We assume that the physician is a Bayesian decision maker and they have some priors, H naught, and those priors have some variance, sigma naught, which represents the uncertainty a priori about the appropriate choice. We also assume that the physician makes an assessment of the patient's health status. So their assessment is related to the true health status, and then there's some error. The error is normally distributed with mean zero and a variance sigma squared D, and the diagnostic skill of the physician then is the inverse of that variance. So the better the physician is at determining the condition of the patient, then the bigger D will be. Okay, so given that setup, it's possible to show that the theta term is equal to the middle expression here. So theta depends on the measurement error in our index, D, which is our measure of diagnostic skill, and then a sort of complicated term which includes patient preferences. Okay, so if patients were randomly assigned to doctors, that patient preference term would drop out, and theta would depend mainly on the diagnostic skill of the physician. The physician-specific intercept depends on all the other parameters of the model. Okay, so the first example, C-section, is interesting for our purposes, because first of all, it's believed that there are too many C-sections. In the US, the rate is about 35%. In Canada, it's about 29%. The World Health Organization says that the optimal rate, I don't know how they arrive at that, but is about 15%, and that the marginal C-section is therefore unnecessary. And there have been a lot of discussion about different policies to reduce C-section, often taking the form of doing things like reducing reimbursements for C-section relative to normal deliveries. Another good thing about C-sections, from our point of view, is that we observe a lot of characteristics of the mother and of the pregnancy and of the baby that we can use to form an estimate of who's a good candidate for C-section and who isn't. We observe outcomes, both infant health outcomes and maternal health outcomes. And C-section is the most commonly performed surgical procedure. So this last thing is actually quite important, because if you're going to try and use big data, you have to pick something where there's a lot of data. We're going to apply this to data from New Jersey for about a million electronic birth records collected between 1997 and 2006. The records have risk factors for C-section. They have delivery method, of course, and the various outcomes, complications of labor and delivery, late maternal complications, infant health outcomes, including infant death, codes for the physician and the hospital, and also demographics of the patients and residential address. The outcomes we consider are maternal outcomes, such as excessive bleeding, fever, seizures, bad infant health outcomes. I should have put fetal distress in this, but meconium goes along with fetal distress, birth injury, infant death. And in some of what I'm going to talk about, we're just going to put these things all together and talk about any bad outcome. In order to estimate the medical risk for C-section, we estimate a LOGIT using all 10 years of the data. There are lots of medical risk factors: age, previous C-section, parity, whether it's a multiple birth. In this model, we try and include only things that we think affect the medical risk and not things like race or insurance status, which probably affect the procedure choice but don't determine the medical necessity of the procedure. The model explains about a third of the variation in outcomes, and the ranking of patients is very robust to estimating the model different ways. For example, we could use only early years of the data, use only doctors who got good outcomes, omit some variables that might be more controversial, such as previous C-section, from the model. Okay, so for example, this graph is showing the distribution of propensity scores over time, and the light blue bars here are 1997, the white bars are 2006, and you can see that the distribution changes very little over time for this particular example. This is showing the actual LOGIT, two different versions. On your right is the one for all of the doctors in the sample. On the left is the one for the top quartile of doctors in terms of outcomes. You can see there are some differences in the coefficients, but that the overall pattern is very similar. Okay, so given this index of appropriateness, we then have to come up with measures of diagnostic skill, procedural skill, and prices. For diagnostic skill, following the model, we're going to take each doctor's cases and regress the probability of C-section on the patient propensity index and use that slope coefficient as a measure of diagnostic skill. For procedural skill, we use the rate of bad outcomes for the high-risk cases, less the rate of bad outcomes for the low-risk cases. And for prices, we use the hospital-level difference in the prices. And this figure just shows what's been going on with the prices of C-section versus normal delivery in New Jersey. Turning to some means, if we divide the sample into the low-risk people and the high-risk people, so here I'm just dividing it in half, you can see, not surprisingly, that the high-risk people are more likely to have C-sections, but there's a lot of low-risk people who are also having C-sections. The high-risk people are also more likely to have bad outcomes. Most of the difference is in bad maternal outcomes. The incidence of bad child outcomes is pretty similar across the two groups, although you do have a higher risk of neonatal death for the high-risk group. If we look at the doctor characteristics who are treating these different groups of patients, they're actually remarkably similar. The doctors who treat the low risk treat slightly more patients over the whole 10 years, only 20 more. The measures of diagnostic skill and procedural skill here are normalized using a Z-score, so they have a mean of 0 and a variance of 1. And so you can see that the doctors who are treating the low risk are slightly less skilled, but only slightly. And maybe the biggest difference between these two groups is that the ones who are treating the high risk are more specialized in treating high-risk patients. There's also differences in the patient characteristics. And remember, I didn't include race or insurance coverage when I was defining high risk and low risk. But it turns out that the low risk are more likely to be minority, are more likely to be on Medicaid than the high risk. They're also likely to be younger. Okay, so the empirical model, then, is to have an outcome as a function of these measures of diagnostic skill, procedural skill, prices, characteristics of the patient. We include hospital fixed effects in all of these models so that we're looking at doctors within a hospital. We include the day of admission, the month of admission, the year, and the zip code of the patient. Now, there aren't huge differences in doctor characteristics between the types of doctors serving high-risk and low-risk patients, but nevertheless, people do choose doctors or physician practices for C-section. So we have to deal with selection. And we do that by trying to instrument individual doctor skill measures with market skill measures. We define a market as all the hospitals within 5 miles of a woman's residence, plus any other hospital that at least 3 women from her zip code used in the delivery year. And then the market measure is constructed by taking a weighted average of physician skill levels in the market. This figure shows some examples of those markets. So you can see, looking at the orange lines, what the market looks like for Princeton. Princeton has a hospital. Most people in Princeton deliver in the Princeton hospital. But lots of people actually go to hospitals that are some distance away. And one advantage of using this kind of a market measure, as opposed to, say, drawing circles, is that you can see if I drew a circle that was big enough to include all the hospitals where people actually go, it would also include a lot of hospitals where no one from Princeton goes. Also, this method of defining a market allows the same hospital to be in different markets. Okay. This instrument works pretty well. You can see from the first stage regressions that the market level measures are highly predictive of the individual doctor measures. So turning to some results, here I've divided the patients into the lowest quartile of risk, the highest quartile of risk, and the two quartiles in the middle. What this shows is that better diagnostic skill is associated with lower probability of C-section among the low risk and higher probability of C-section among the high risk. Better procedural skill difference is associated with higher risk of procedures across the board, as I was arguing earlier. If you look at the risk of any bad outcome, better diagnostic skill is associated with a reduction in the incidence of bad outcomes, particularly for people in the middle and high-risk categories. And better procedural skill is associated with reductions in bad outcomes across the board. If I divide the outcomes into the maternal and infant outcomes, I think there's some interesting differences here. Better diagnostic skill is associated with a lower probability of bad outcomes for mothers, but also with a lower probability of bad outcomes for high-risk infants. And again, better procedural skill is associated with lower risk of bad outcomes across the board. So how large are these effects? A one standard deviation increase in diagnostic skill reduces C-section among the low risk by about 15%, but increases it among the high risk by about 10%. So unlike a lot of the analyses that just say, well, there's too many C-sections, we're actually saying, you know, there's too few C-sections among the highest risk people. There are people who need procedures who are not getting them. This change reduces the incidence of bad outcomes for mothers among the low risk and among infants among the high risk, both by about 12%. And a one standard deviation increase in procedural skill, which might be very difficult to pull off, would nevertheless reduce the risk of bad outcomes by about 50%, especially for the high risk. The second example we have is heart attacks, this time using data from Florida. We have all of the patients who were hospitalized from the emergency room for heart attack between 1992 and 2011. So here, we're arguing that there's not a lot of selection because these are people who just had a heart attack, went to the hospital, got whoever was there. The choice that we're considering is whether they get an angioplasty versus something else. Most of the time, this something else is going to be clot-busting drugs. We're going to measure diagnostic skill in the same way as a slope. And we're also going to look at the intercept, the doctor's mean propensity to use invasive procedures. Here, unlike in the C-section case, the best practice changes a lot over time. So what we use as a standard are what doctors in hospitals with cardiology teaching programs do, and then we allow that to change every year. Our model of whether the patient is appropriate for the procedure, the invasive procedure or not, considers the patient diagnosis, because there's different types of heart attacks, the patient age, and comorbidities, like whether they have congestive heart failure or not. We're going to estimate doctor-specific slopes, and in this data, we have doctor characteristics, and we thought it would be interesting to be able to see how the doctor's behavior changes with experience, and so we estimate a different slope for each 3 years of practice. Our model explains about 12% of the variation in procedure choice. This table, which probably people in the back can't see, is just showing differences in mean patient characteristics by appropriateness for surgery. And the thing that really jumps out at you is that the people who are not good candidates for invasive surgery are much older than the people who are good candidates for invasive surgery. They're also more likely to have other comorbidities like congestive heart failure. Okay, so basically what our model is telling us is that you shouldn't do invasive surgeries on people who are very old and very sick. If we look at the outcomes and how they vary between the two groups, we have whether you got the invasive procedure. And again, there's a lot of people who don't seem to be very appropriate for surgery who are getting it anyway. The length of stay is about the same for the two groups, but the costs are much higher for the high appropriateness group. And then the three lines at the bottom here are the health outcomes that we can look at. One is whether you got a hospital-acquired condition. So this is something like a C. difficile infection from the hospital. Whether you were discharged home, which is what you would like if you're in the hospital. And then the last one is whether you died in the hospital. So among our low appropriateness for surgery group, about 15% of them die in the hospital. And in the high appropriateness group, about 9% of them die in the hospital. Here we set things up a little bit differently. We're going to regress an outcome on a 0-1 index for low responsiveness, which is defined as a physician who has a slope that's significantly less than 1. We don't actually see any physicians who have, or not very many physicians, who have slopes that are significantly greater than 1. Then we also consider physicians who are not very aggressive, that is, they just do a small number of procedures on average, and ones who are very aggressive. They do lots of procedures. And again, those are defined by saying whether they're significantly less than zero or significantly greater than zero. We include patient conditions, hospital fixed effects, the quarter that the heart attack occurred in. Okay. So the outcomes here suggest that if you're not very appropriate for surgery and you're dealing with a physician who's not paying attention to the fact that you're not very appropriate for surgery, you're more likely to get a hospital-acquired infection, you're more likely to die in the hospital, and you're less likely to be discharged home. The high appropriateness patients are also less likely to be discharged home. And in this case, the sort of omitted category here is that you got transferred to a different hospital. So the high appropriateness people who come in and are faced with a low responsiveness surgeon end up getting transferred to a different hospital. And then you can see also that the low aggressiveness people are less likely to have low appropriateness patients die in the hospital, also less likely to have them discharged home, and again, more likely to have them transferred to a different hospital. If you look at costs, what you see here is that the people who aren't very appropriate for surgery, if they have a low responsiveness surgeon, have higher costs and higher probability of an invasive procedure. If they're a high appropriateness person and they get a low responsiveness surgeon, then they're less likely to have an invasive procedure and have lower costs. Okay? And then the aggressiveness works in the way you would expect. If you have somebody who's not very aggressive, they have low costs. If you have somebody who's very aggressive, they tend to have high costs. Okay, so again, how large are these effects? If the doctor is significantly less responsive than the standard, the patient has an 8.7% higher probability of dying in the hospital and a 7% lower probability of being discharged home. So this is actually a pretty significant thing that you wouldn't want to have one of these surgeons if it was you. Turning to how the physician characteristics predict practice style, we show models here for the patient's or the doctor's responsiveness and the doctor's aggressiveness. Both of these things are very sticky. You see that your responsiveness this period is highly predicted by your responsiveness last period. Experience does have an effect, but it's a pretty small effect, so it takes a long time for experience to move people away from wherever it is that they start. People who graduated from U.S. medical schools are both more responsive and more aggressive than people who graduated overseas. But we don't find any effect of graduating from a top 20 U.S. medical school, which we thought was kind of surprising. So what we take away from this is that physician practice style is very sticky, depends on past practice. That doctors become more responsive and more aggressive over time, but only slowly. U.S.-trained doctors are more responsive and more aggressive, but again, there's no effect of attending more highly ranked medical schools. So whatever they're teaching them there is not being reflected in these measures of physician practice style. So traditional models of human capital emphasize formal education and learning on the job. Our results suggest that despite many years of training, a lot of doctors are making systematic errors in decisions and that learning on the job is only taking place slowly. Perhaps one reason for this is that doctors have only their own experience to rely on and are not able to make use of all the data that's out there about, you know, the millions of patients and millions of patient outcomes that are happening. We think these results suggest that simple machine learning protocols could be used to identify doctors whose behavior deviates systematically from accepted norms. Using these protocols to change physician behavior could have positive health consequences. And I really want to emphasize, we're not saying that anybody should go out and use exactly our model to say what doctors should do. This is a very crude model. But we're looking at it more as a sort of proof of concept in that if we can take this data that is crude and doesn't include a lot of information that doctors would have on hand, and we can still identify people who are not being very responsive to patient conditions, then it ought to be possible to do a lot better job given the kind of big data that is routinely collected. We think that the development of treatment protocols that evolved over time and accounted for multiple dimensions of patient condition would be a big improvement on the type of simple checklists that are currently being used and would offer a potential way to improve the cost-effectiveness of medical care and patient outcomes. So I think I said this already. Okay, so just to conclude, despite years of training and learning on the job, the things that labor economists traditionally think about, many doctors are making systematic mistakes. Doctors currently have no way to take advantage of all of the information that's out there. Existing protocols are simple checklists which are very static and do not address important diagnostic decisions. Machine learning algorithms offer a potentially powerful and more dynamic way to guide decision-making by incorporating multiple aspects of patient condition, as well as you could incorporate interactions between them. And even crude algorithms like ours could be a useful aid to expert decision-making. One final observation I want to make, turning to the question of whether these results shed any light on how to evaluate experts in other domains. One of the things that occurred to me eventually while I was doing this is that, well, doctors are actually easier to evaluate than a lot of people because we see what they do. We have information about the procedures and we have information about the outcomes. If you contrast that to the way that we try and evaluate teachers, for example, we never collect any information about what the teachers do. We only look at the outcomes of the students, and then we try and deal with all the various selection problems. So perhaps one takeaway from this is that identifying the significant aspects of expert performance and trying to measure them might be a first step in better evaluations of expert performance. So that's all I have to say, and I'd be very happy to take any questions.
Right, so if you have a question, just raise your hand. We have three microphone runners, so we can should be able to get to you.
So the so our model kind of builds on the Chandra-Steger model because in the Chandra-Steger model there's only the gamma basically. You're either a low person or a high person in terms of doing procedures, and there's only that dimension of skill. So we try and measure that dimension of skill, and we say yes, that's very important. So if you're going to have surgery, you definitely want to get the hotshot surgeon. But their model doesn't really consider the second aspect that we're trying to highlight here, which is, are you good at deciding who needs to get the procedure? Okay, so there are
You know, another thing actually that I get asked frequently is, well, couldn't you have a team decide? And in fact, some hospitals that get better outcomes, like the Intermountain Hospital or the Mayo Clinic, do have teams of doctors make decisions and get better outcomes. So, you know, machine learning may not be the only way to do things, but as medical care is set up in most hospitals, doctors get to make their own decisions, and so something that would help them to make better decisions could improve outcomes, even if you left the rates of procedure use the same.
Thank you for a very nice presentation. My question is related now to the definition of good doctors in the context of the protocol and the checklist. I don't know about the American setting of the system, but the Swedish system, for example, is based in the team of nurses. And this list of aspirin and what you show us as binary variables, they, I assume that they are not done by the doctors. And in this setting, I'm thinking how we call the good doctor, because the protocol is not always linked to the doctor. It might be the responsibility of the staff around the doctor. And the question is related more because I got your point, I don't know the paper, but how we define good doctors if it is a list of protocols? And
so in our, I think that's a very good point. In our data, the person that's identified as the attending physician. The attending physician is legally responsible for the decisions that are made, but that doesn't mean in real life that they're actually always the person that's making the decision. But that's the only person that we can observe. So that's another thing that if you had better data, you would probably want to do a better job on, is making sure that you had identified the person who really made the decision.
One of the things that you started out with was the checklist, and oftentimes in these medical checklists, there's kind of, you have to have three of the five or some things, and yes, it's okay to go, and if you don't have that number, then it's not, and so forth, which is kind of a Leontief model of what's involved, and in some sense, the model that you have is one that smooths that out and allows trade-offs. So somebody's worse on some dimension, that trades off with being better on another. How much do you have a sense of, I guess two questions. One, how much this kind of probably misspecified Leontief aspect is involved? And then the second question is how you would implement a guidance to physicians to get, would you put it into a checklist or would you put it into a probabilistic form or how would you do it? And then, you know, you see what I mean. That is, at the end, how would you guide the physician to say which is the appropriate thing to do in this case?
So what I have in mind is, and I think this would be totally feasible, although I might not, I'm probably not the right person to do it, but is to have a system where the physician would sort of enter all the characteristics of the patient, and then it would come back with comment that says like, well, you know, 80% of patients like this get this procedure. And I think you could do something like take the best hospitals practice or the hospitals that get the best outcomes, look at what's actually going on. And the other advantage besides, having it be a little bit more nuanced than just the sort of Leontief way of doing things would be that you could also have it update in real time because practice does change over time. And these checklists tend to be very static. You know, they make a checklist And then they have some giant committee that meets for 10 years and then updates the checklist, and then you have that one for another 10 years. So if there was some agreement that we could use a machine learning algorithm to take out what signal is in all the data, which is collected continuously, we could have a continuously updating protocol. So that's kind of the idea that I have in mind.
In the case of the C sections, we have a complication that many of the women ask for a C-section because it's convenient for them to have the birth on Friday or Thursday rather than Monday. But in other cases, and there the diagnostic is very clear what the woman suffers from. But in other cases, the major problem of the physician is the diagnostic. In other words, realizing what's the right treatment, what the patient suffers from, and how do you handle this where the information is not clear?
So actually people always say that about the C-sections, and I'm sure it's true that some people do ask for them. That's why we use the instrumental variables, and so to the extent that that deals with the endogeneity of patient choice or physician selection, that's one answer. Another thing is that one of the things that we highlight is that there's a lot of people who need C-sections who aren't getting them and have bad health outcomes. And so that evidently has nothing to do with people asking for C-sections. That's clearly a mistake on the part of the doctors. So, I mean, the kind of shocking thing is that I can take these New Jersey birth records, run a regression, identify a woman who had, you know, preeclampsia, breech birth, all these things, any one of them would say you should do a C-section, and she didn't have a C-section. And lo and behold, you know, some terrible thing happened. You know, so there are clearly mistakes being made.
Could you just talk a little bit more about the institutional structure, so the mistakes being made point that you point just made, if there are any repercussions for that? So certainly I would expect that hospitals would be very interested in this kind of more comprehensive protocol and getting better outcomes. But even with those simple protocols, it seems like you could tell us that they're not following the protocols, and if there are any repercussions to the career of the doctor, or if they're being dismissed, or if it has to rise to the level of a lawsuit.
Well, the simple protocols are actually pretty effective in that most of those CMS protocols, when they're first introduced, they're thought of as sometimes thought of as measures of hospital quality. And there'll be some hospitals that do them and some hospitals that don't. But if you look, like 3 or 4 years later, all the hospitals are doing them, right? But the point I was trying to make, say, with that heart attack protocol is even if you did all those things perfectly, there's nothing in the protocol that says that, you know, you made a mistake by doing the thing on this person to begin with. In terms of whether there are consequences, you know, we hear a lot about people being sued and making decisions because they're afraid of being sued. Almost everybody that's looked at that doesn't actually find very much effect of that on doctor decision making. People have looked in different ways. So sometimes they do chart reviews and find places where there were medical errors. Like 80% of the medical errors, there's never any lawsuit, never any consequence. So I guess I think the whole thing about lawsuits driving doctor behavior is pretty overblown.
It would seem, as an economist, it would seem that there would be a role for the private market, you know, to get in there and actually improve outcomes. But you're saying there isn't. There hasn't been a response, really.
I mean, the healthcare market is a really interesting market, in part because it's probably the most screwed up market in the world, right? Nobody has information about anything. And so one way to frame what I'm talking about is giving people more information.
Okay, thank you all for the questions. Let's thank Janet one more time.